Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
The State House took center stage in this week's news as lawmakers and the governor reached agreement on a budget. Republican Senator and Majority Leader Jeb Bradley used a music analogy to express his feelings about the deal.
It's true in rock and roll, and it's true in life. You can't always get what you want. Today, New Hampshire is going to get what it needs.
Also, Democrats and the governor said they were pleased, with Governor Hassan calling the deal a win for both parties.
Bipartisanship is about having the capacity to air your differences and sometimes have very strong differences, but then find ways to come together and move forward anyway.
This week saw primary elections in Manchester, where there's a mayoral race underway. Mayor Ted Gatsis and Alderman Joyce Craig were the top vote getters, so they'll compete later this fall. Here's Gatsis after the tally came in.
Well, we're very excited. We won 10 of 12 wards. It was a good win, and we look forward to starting a campaign tomorrow and making sure we give the voters an opportunity to differentiate between myself and Alderman Craig so that they have a true difference.
Democratic presidential candidates begin arriving in New Hampshire this weekend for the state party's convention, while earlier in the week, some Republican contenders attended a Seacoast Chili Fest. At the event, Carly Fiorina addressed undeclared GOP voters who may consider her as one of their top favorites.
Wherever I am on your list, whether you're already totally sold or I'm in your top two or three, go ahead and admit it that in your heart of hearts, every one of you want to see me debate Hillary Clinton.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Rick Stevens, Associated Press correspondent for Northern New England. Rick, good to see you.
Nice to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Kevin Landrigan, correspondent with NH1 News. Kevin, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Great to be back, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of NHPoliticalCapital.com. And Dean, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, let's all talk about the budget for just a few minutes, gentlemen, although we sat down with a panel of lawmakers yesterday. Everybody seemed pretty happy with the final product and happy that it was over. What do you think, Kevin? Happiness all around or not?
Yeah, I think I think relief is probably the best word. I mean, this has been more than an 8-month-long saga that people thought might go on even longer than it ended up going. I still think there are some partisan kind of bruised egos, despite some of the sound we heard in the open. I think Republican legislative leaders are still trying to wonder what was all the fuss about, meaning we got the budget we really wanted. We got the tax cuts we really wanted. We gave up on the state pay raise over a month and a half ago. Why did it take the governor this long to come to this agreement?
Yeah, well, and Senator Morse, the president of the state Senate, said pretty much that with us yesterday, that this was the budget that we wanted in the first place.
Well, first of all, I like the budget. I mean, it's the budget that we passed in June. We voted on it. We got it passed now. I think that's good for the people in New Hampshire. But accelerating the tax cuts and putting them in place now, I think we're going to grow the economy in New Hampshire by doing that. And that's what we were trying to say all along, and we got that done yesterday, and I think that's important for New Hampshire.
Again, that's Republican Senator Chuck Morse, the Senate president, speaking in the exchange yesterday about the budget. And Dean Spiliotis, you know, we can talk about the finances of the budget in a minute, but what are the politics of this? Kevin alluded to it, but I'd love to hear from you, too.
Right. Well, I think the most immediate impact is going to be on giving Governor Hassan an opportunity to decide whether or not she's going to run for U.S. Senate. There's been a lot of talk about how until the budget was resolved, she really would not be able to take a good look at that. There's now been some speculation that she was going to announce something this weekend at the Democratic convention in Manchester. She has said she's not going to do that, but that she understands that she needs to decide sooner rather than later, because there are other Democrats we could talk about who are kind of stacking up for a possible gubernatorial run should she decide to run for the Senate. You know, it's interesting. This reminds me a lot of the last budget cycle in which, you know, Republicans got much of what they wanted. But Governor Hassan sort of is very good at kind of recasting it as kind of bipartisanship. And, you know, she figures out a way to get some credit for it, which is what you want to do as a politician, whether it's the pay raise or a promise to discuss the renewal of the Medicaid expansion early in the next term, or, you know, the additional money for mental health and drug treatment and recovery, et cetera. She's very good as a politician at kind of casting this as a success for everybody. But I think the underlying mechanics is sort of pretty much what the Republicans wanted in terms of those. These are the first business tax cuts in 20 years in the state.
And they'll be able to tout that on the campaign trail. Big
Absolutely.
Success.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Rick Stevens, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, there's certainly plenty of political intrigue and legislative machinations. But Kevin, I think, used the right word right off the bat, was relief. And because there was a real downrange effect to this budget, this continuing resolution, substance abuse providers, Dean referenced, the charter schools, yeah, the home care aides, they were all operating under old money and not getting the increases they expected and that they were budgeting for, not to mention the state agencies that were, you know, you think of transportation trying to buy salt for the next winter or trying to plan out their paving and reconstruction programs. They couldn't do it. They were on hold. So now you've got this sort of collective exhale. Now they can go, okay, we can get back to business now.
So think there's a financial exhale, Rick.
Definitely.
You know,
financial.
Some of this stuff can get moving. And a political exhale that Dean mentioned, because now people can start planning their political careers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and the tax cuts, if we could just talk about it for another minute, and Kevin Landergren, help us out. So this was the big crux of the debate between Democrats and Republicans. And Republicans gave a little to Governor Hassan, acknowledging her concerns that these tax cuts in business taxes might blow a hole in the budget, as she put it.
Yeah. They created there was really a classic give and take here, which is the Republicans got some of what they wanted, and the governor, as you alluded to, got an important caveat. What the Republicans got? They got, as Senator Morse just mentioned, they got a bigger tax cut early on. The tax cuts, both cutting the business profits tax, which is the corporate tax, primarily paid by very large corporations, many of them headquartered outside the state. Almost more than half of them, by the way, headquartered outside of America.
And wow, really?
Yes. And they,
such as? Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm interested in that.
Well,
headquartered outside of America.
Sure. I mean, you have BAE Systems, which, you know, ostensibly is an English company. You've got several of these banks in New Hampshire that are English-owned, Scottish-owned. You've got a lot of Asian companies that have big offices here as well. The other tax cut was in the business enterprise tax. It's paid by all companies, whether you make money or you don't make money. And that's why the Speaker of the House was insistent. We've got to cut both those taxes because there's a different universe. What did the governor get? She got a trigger, which means the second half of the tax cut does not occur if by the end of 2017, all state revenues don't actually grow slightly as a result. Her argument has always been you cut business taxes, you hemorrhage our existing revenue structure. The Republicans have said you cut business taxes, you get more economic growth, and you get more revenues. This will test that. And that second half of the tax cut goes away if the trigger isn't reached.
So it's kind of a wait and see, kind of like what New Hampshire did on the cigarette tax a couple years ago, right, Kevin? You know, we'll cut it for now, but if revenues don't keep up, it comes back. Is that a good analogy?
Yeah,
or not?
No, it's a great analogy. I mean, it was the first cigarette tax cut in state history. And what's really interesting about that is I'll try not to get into weeds here, but That cigarette tax cut was done away with because we didn't actually make that trigger. And what does that have to do with this budget deal? Republican legislative leaders to this day, that happened in 2011, suspected that there were people in the Department of Revenue Administration that sat on tax stamps and didn't report them until after June 30th so that the tax cut would go away. What does that have to do with this deal? The Department of Revenue Administration in this deal doesn't actually count the general revenues and report on whether that trigger is met or not. It's a legislative budget assistant who does it.
A different entity.
Not only a different entity, an employee of the legislature actually counts the revenues and reports whether the trigger is met or not.
Wow. So there's a possible trust factor there, as we have seen in the past.
Absolutely.
Well, yesterday on the exchange, we asked Speaker Jasper, you know, when might we know that these tax cuts have been a success? And let's hear what Speaker Jasper said.
This is a long-term plan. I think that the benefits in the short term are not going to be something that we can really recognize. I think this is something that may be 6, 7, 8 years out before we start to see the full effect of that. And we're going to know that by, is our job growth exceeding that of our neighbors? And I think that's going to be the metric. When if this goes on and we're not seeing job growth greater than what's going on in Massachusetts or Maine or Vermont, any of our neighboring states, then I think it probably hasn't done what it was designed to do.
Again, that's Speaker Sean Jasper on the exchange yesterday talking about the budget deal and the tax cuts that it included. Join us with your questions and comments here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we cover this story and many, many other headlines around the Granite State this week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So a couple more questions about the budget. So as we said earlier, the Republicans were happy, Dean, because this is pretty much their budget. What did Governor Hassan and Democrats get out of this, besides at least an end to the stalemate?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's no small thing given all the sort of political issues swirling around the coming election. Well, I mean, they did get the state pay raise, which is something that will be popular. I am hearing some unhappiness from the progressive wing of the party in the state, but it's not the first time they've been unhappy with Governor Hassan, much in the same way they were often unhappy with John Lynch. These are typically more centrist politicians than your sort of typical New Hampshire progressive who might be supporting, let's say, Bernie Sanders in the presidential race. So there is some unhappiness that the Democrats kind of caved, that this essentially these are the business tax cuts that the Republican wanted, and the threshold is really not that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things. But she did get the 2% pay raise, which was important to state employees, and this they'll revisit the Medicaid expansion coming up. I think people are just kind of happy to have it over, try to cast it as a bipartisan success. But there is for sure some disappointment among people on the left that this was essentially a cave.
All right. Well, let's hear what Representative Mary Jane Wallner, a leading Democrat representative from Concord, said about this yesterday.
Well, I'm very happy that we've been able to pass the budget, and we're going to move forward, and state government will continue to operate. And I was particularly pleased about the state employee pay raise. I think our state employees are very deserving of a pay raise. It's 2%. And I think that they really – it's not very much, but they certainly deserve it. Things that I am a little disappointed is that Medicaid expansion is not there. But I think we have a good faith promise that in January we're going to really debate it, and we're going to really look at it closely. And I'm very optimistic that we'll move forward.
Again, that's Mary Jane Wallner, Democratic representative from Concord, speaking about the budget and the exchange yesterday. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we look at some of the top New Hampshire headlines of the week. And gentlemen, let's go to John first in Thornton. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
Listen to you all the time. My question is this. I don't know if maybe you don't quite understand it, but if you have a lot of business tax cuts, corporate tax cuts, money is going to disappear right away. And as Speaker House Jaffa just said, that it's going to be a 6-7 year before we find out if we're going to benefit from this. How do you fill that void now the next year? You're digging in my pocket, or how does that happen? Am I right in saying this money we lose this money right away, and now we have to wait 6 to 7 so many years to benefit this?
Well, John, thanks for the question. And, Kevin, I'll turn to you for that one.
Sure. Well, thanks, John. It's a good question. It's a real good question. Couple of things. One, business taxes, significant part of our revenue structure, but not like a super dominant part. I mean, the two business taxes generate about 30% of the roughly $4.4 billion that we get in revenue each year. I mean, this tax structure of the state is kind of like a freighter on the sea, you know, and which is if the winds are calm and it's pleasant weather, the freighter will move along. It won't crash into anything. It should be fine. But if the winds are strong and the sun is out, it will actually generate even more force. I make that point in that as a general rule, our tax structure does not exist on whether tax cuts generate revenue or they actually lose revenue. Our tax structure, which is, as we know, very restrictive, operates on the model of the general economy. If the economy is good, our tax system generates ongoing increases in revenue. They're not super dominant. They're never huge that you see with an income tax or a sales tax. They're not 8%, 10% a year. But in healthy economies, they're 3 to 5%. Now, that 3 to 5% growth, John, should be enough to overcome the loss in revenue from the business tax cuts. Now, if we head into another recession and we know we're in an economy that's kind of shaky, the reverse is true. We'll lose more revenue, not less revenue as a result.
Okay, Dean.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And I think, you know, part of the initial debate and the Hassan veto was over the size of the potential hole, but you know, these tax cuts are at like all fiscal policy is kind of a it's sort of an imperfect instrument. There are lags involved, but there is also sometimes a psychological benefit. So, you know, New Hampshire gets the reputation as a sort of a business tax cutting state that's going to attract industry, even if the benefits are not immediate. I mean, that's kind of the psychology behind it for people who support those cuts. So there may be some kind of short-term benefit in terms of bringing people in, even though the actual fiscal impact is lagged.
All right. Well, John, thank you for the question. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Well, in addition to all the work on the budget that the legislature and the governor put in this week, Rick Stevens, there were a couple other vetoes by the governor that were sustained this week. In other words, not overridden, but this is pro forma. The legislature every year after the session gets together in a special session and says, do we want to try and override these vetoes? So a couple that did not get overridden, the concealed carry permit, which is called constitutional carry. What's this all about?
This is there's two phases of being allowed to carry a gun out of sight. You have to first get the original license that everybody needs to carry a handgun, and then you apply to your local police department to get a license that would allow you to carry it on a holster under your coat, a shoulder holster, out of sight, in other words. Senator Jeb Bradley, who was a big supporter of this, says it's enshrined in the Constitution. That's why they call it the constitutional carry, that everybody should have that, that ability. But the interesting thing I thought anyway is that even police departments, they don't like the constitutional carry because they say it makes them less safe. It makes their officers less safe if they go to a house and they don't know that this guy's got a background of violence or instability. If they know that, if the police chief knows that John Doe really shouldn't be able to keep a gun in his belt and under a sweater, then that gives the officers the upper hand if they have a confrontation with this. And that was – so it came down to a battle between public safety and the constitutionality of the Second Amendment.
And the lead sponsor of this, Jeb Bradley, says, hey, I'm disappointed that the veto was not overridden, but I'll be back, right?
Jeb will bring it back next session, I expect. Yep. And the gun control measures tend to come up every cycle. The other one that we didn't mention was voter residency. Would have required a 30-day – you have to live in the state 30 days before you can register to vote. Republicans or supporters, rather, said that it would crack down on voter fraud. others, the opponents of it, said it would disenfranchise some voters.
And that veto also was sustained. All right, more after a short break. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guests for the roundup this week are Rick Stevens, Associated Press Correspondent for Northern New England, Kevin Landrigan, he's Chief Political Correspondent with NH1 News, and Dean Spiliota, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of NHPoliticalCapital.com. One more time, that exchange number for you to join us as we cover some of the top stories of the week around New Hampshire, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's turn now to housing and the lack of affordable housing options. That was the focus this week of the state's business leaders. And Dave Solomon of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News covered the story. He's on the line. Hi, Dave. Thank you.
Good morning, Laura.
So who's calling for more affordable housing, Dave?
Well, there have been many parties calling for more affordable housing in New Hampshire for decades, going back to the mid-'80s, when then-Governor Sununu first helped introduce an affordable housing trust fund. But more recently, it's become a pressing concern for the businesses in the state, as the Business and Industry Association statewide chamber held its housing summit last week, and we heard stories from large employers about the difficulty they were having in attracting talent now because of the housing prices and availability.
So what does affordable mean? And you don't need to give us an exact dollar figure, Dave, but just help us with that.
Well, affordable means when you take the median income in a particular area and compare it to the median housing prices, someone can afford rent or mortgage at a range of about 25% of their income, household income.
Yeah.
Those are hard numbers to make work in most parts of New Hampshire right now.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Did people talk at this forum, Dave, about where, especially in the state, this affordability is an issue?
Well, it's really a big issue in the areas where there's a lot of employment. Particularly severe in the Hanover and Lebanon area, where Dartmouth-Hitchcock and a lot of the institutions up there are big employers, and the highly paid professional positions that they want to hire for can't afford some of the housing there. They talked about how they have to pay relocation bonuses of $50,000 to $100,000 to make up the difference, and they even have skilled professionals commuting from Claremont.
Wow, it's a long drive.
Yeah.
Well, how much is the problem? I wonder if this came up, Dave. How much is the problem, the cost of housing, and how much is it low wages? I mean, we hear a lot about wage stagnation. Maybe the problem isn't that housing's too expensive, it's that people don't make enough. Did anybody talk about that?
Well, it's a little bit of both. Wages have been stagnant since the Great Recession in 08 and 09, and yet the same recession put a lot of pressure on rental prices, because as homes were foreclosed, those individuals flooded the rental market and jacked up prices in a state that has a very low level of rental housing compared to other states, because we don't have a lot of urban areas where rental housing is usually concentrated. So it's been a double whammy. Wages have been held down, and rents have gone sky high. And in some parts of the state, it's cheaper to pay a mortgage than it is to rent an apartment.
What's holding some of these rental projects back, Dave? If everybody wants it and the business community is behind it, what's holding it back?
This was a big theme of the conference last week. There is land use regulations, as they've been developed by the communities around the state, have in many cases discouraged the construction of apartments, attached condos, multifamily housing, which is usually the key to making it affordable. In many cases, these are the communities that are closest to the employment centers. You take Nashua, next door is Hollis, a community that's virtually ruled out affordable housing by either its zoning regulations or by actually purchasing land when it becomes available and setting it aside for conservation. So we have land use regulations in the state that discourage multi-family housing, and we do not have a lot of incentives or funding in to offset that.
Well, beyond highlighting the issue, what role does the business community see itself playing, Dave, in this issue?
Lobbying the legislature for funding better funding of the state's Affordable Housing Fund, perhaps linking the funding, linking it to a more stable funding source, like the revenue from the real estate transfer taxes, as many other states do, and also lobbying for state legislation or some type of enabling legislation that would require communities to do some part of their share to allow for multifamily housing construction and give developers some option outside of going to the courts when communities engage in what's called exclusionary or snob zoning.
Oh, interesting. So even though the legislature really isn't in charge of these on-the-ground decisions, some businesses are saying, hey, legislature, help us out with these local zoning and regulatory decisions.
Yeah, come up with ways to incentivize communities to allow some parts of their within their border where multifamily housing can be constructed without encountering insurmountable opposition.
That gets into local control, doesn't it, Dave? I mean, incentivize or force, depending on how you look at it.
Well, there are issues of local control, but there's a tension between the question of local control and the question of when does zoning become exclusionary, unfair, and even discriminatory, and which interest should prevail. Local control or prohibition against exclusionary and discriminatory housing practices.
All right, Dave, real interesting. Thank you very much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
That's Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, again, covering a story this week about business leaders extremely concerned about the lack of affordable housing in New Hampshire. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange, and let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we cover some of the top stories around New Hampshire this week, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Kevin Landrigan, Rick Stevens, and Dean Spiliotis, let's go right back to our listeners. PJ is calling from Whitefield. Hi, PJ. Go ahead. You're on the
air.
Good
morning. Thank you. Good morning.
Sure.
Hey, I wanted to comment two things. One about kind of the failure of Bill O'Brien to influence anything about anybody. He claimed he needed 120 votes to squash the budget, and only 73 people voted against it. So I kind of think his influence has always been exaggerated, over-exaggerated. And secondly, out of that vote, 18 legislators never even showed up. I had to look at the roster, and like 18 were listed as not excused. So if the parties can't get people to step up for the biggest vote of the year, I wonder what the, you know, what the failure there is.
Wow. PJ, thank you for the question. And Kevin, I'm going to throw that to you.
Sure.
This vote on the budget was sort of seen, PJ's right, as a test of political power by either Speaker Jasper or former Speaker Bill O'Brien.
Yeah, it was. Really good point by PJ. This was really seen as the last swan song for Bill O'Brien. He's already indicated he's not running for re-election. He's tried to recruit a number of conservative Republicans to run against Sean Jasper, the person you'll recall who became Speaker of the House with House Democratic votes. Bill O'Brien, I think, had overestimated his strength. Actually, he had a little more strength earlier in the day. He had about 95 votes when it came to opposing suspending all these rules and taking up the budget deal. But you're right, in the final analysis, there are only 70. This thing got extremely personal. We saw the Speaker of the House come down off the rostrum, go toe-to-toe, debating Bill O'Brien on the House floor. Almost never happens, but it underscores the level of real anger and deep-seated ill will the two men have for one another right now.
What does that mean, Kevin? I heard that story that, you know, Sean Jasper left the rostrum, which
right.
is sort of that big podium where
right.
he stands because he's a
right.
Speaker of the House, came down, and then what?
And then forcibly debated. I mean, Bill O'Brien's supporters, as BJ may recall if he was following the debate, were essentially arguing that this was a backroom deal and that Jasper and Senate Republicans had come to an agreement with Governor Hassan, and it was a political game. He got very angry. He was red-faced. He said, you know, backroom deals are deals that are made in secret and then are never discussed with the public. Here we are discussing this. This is no backroom deal. Bill O'Brien, just a few feet away, went to the microphone and said, if we were at a school board meeting, we'd never vote on a contract that had been hatched in a in secret by a bunch of people, and there was never a public hearing on it, and never an opportunity for public comment, and we shouldn't do that now. To the level of absenteeism, it was actually a good turnout. It's a function of our 400-person house, the third largest in the free world. It never has perfect attendance.
Yeah, 18 doesn't sound like a lot when
it does not.
400 House lawmakers.
The typical attendance for a House session, PJ, is about 345 to 355. 360 is very good. Over 380, this was the highest attendance of the year.
Okay. Yeah, Dean, to you and also you, Rick, but Dean, you first. Sure. This O'Brien, Jasper, and, you know, we still have 6 months of this session left when they come back in January. So this continues.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you remember back at the beginning of the session, there was a lot of talk about, you know, how the division within the Republican Party was going to play out. You know, in the end, it seems like, you know, Speaker Jasper basically got the agreement he wanted. You know, he presented it as not a backroom deal, but a negotiation, that you often have to do these kinds of things when you're up against a deadline. It's not all that unusual. You know, Bill O'Brien's, you know, sort of power as a kind of a sort of, a, you know, an ideological leader in the party is kind of, you know, it's sort of ebbed and flowed. It's varied over time. But, you know, certainly when he was Speaker, you know, he was in the middle of a lot of pretty significant debates. He also, in some sense, became for a period of time kind of a focal point, or had a lot of national visibility on issues. You know, sort of a kind of a convenient way to kind of talk about the legislature. You know, you have the O'Brien people and the Jasper people or what have you. So there's a little bit of that there. You know, we'll see. We're going to go into 2016. It's going to be an election year. That always puts an added layer of complication. You know, we've talked about the Medicaid expansion, for example.
That's going to be a big issue.
Over 40,000 people have enrolled, or something like that. It's very difficult to take that away once you have something like that out there. I'm going to be very interested to see sort of what the tenor of the debate is, given that it's an election year.
Sure, Rick, go ahead.
Well, the Medicaid issue is going to be huge. As we know, the federal funding starts to trigger down after next year, and they've got a big decision. I want to circle back. When we started the show, Jeb Bradley was on invoking the Rolling Stones, saying, you know, you can't always get what you want. So I was kind of thinking what the theme songs might have been in the House, and maybe Sean Jasper would have Street Fighting Man, while Bill O'Brien would use It's All Over Now. We'll see what it shakes out next year. But it's true. Dean makes a good point. The next 6 months are going to be, and Laura, you made it as well, they're going to be critically important for a lot of important issues, mostly that Medicaid expansion. What happens to those 40,000 people if they pull it back? That's going to be a huge question.
Well, the lawmakers we sat down with, Republicans and Democrats, seemed to feel like there was a solution, at least among the Republicans that we had on. We had on Speaker Jasper and Senate President Morse. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. PJ, thanks for that call. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Rick, the Department of Transportation has a new commissioner, a former manager at the Massachusetts DOT, the second woman to hold the top slot at DOT, Victoria Sheehan. Can you give us a little bio, Rick, on this new commissioner?
Yeah, Victoria Sheehan was the manager of strategic planning at the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. She is lives in Nashua, and the executive council voted to approve her or confirm her, rather, as the commissioner of the Department of Transportation on Wednesday. In sort of an interesting vote, there was one. He called it a soft no. This was Councilor David Wheeler of District 5. Who brought up that he was a little uncomfortable with the fact that Victoria Sheehan is a native of Northern Ireland and had been a citizen here only 3 years. The rest of the council wasn't buying that. I think it was Colin Van Ostrand who said there's no such thing as a half a citizen.
Once you're a citizen, you're good.
Yeah. And the other councilors – so she was confirmed by a 4-1 vote, and all of the councilors noted her technical and engineering expertise. That's what they seem to really laud, someone who knows – how to do this job from the ground up. Governor Haslam didn't speak for or against her nominee, but did praise her work within the Massachusetts Department of Transportation as an example of what she can bring to this.
And I have to ask this, Kevin, I'll turn to you. Sure. The state DOT does seem to have a revolving cast of commissioners, yes. A rotating cast of commissioners. You know, they do seem to get a new one every 2 or 3 or 4 years. Most commissioners are longer lasting than that. How come?
I think it's mainly because and it's been more the case in the last 20 years because there's a structural deficit in the highway fund. It's a burnout job is the best way to put it. The system lacks about $50 million in revenue that it needs in order to stay ahead of the schedule for construction work in the state. I mean, and people will come back and they'll say, well, wait a minute, we increased the gas tax last year. We did that for the first time in more than 20 years. Where'd the money go? Well, almost half of the money went to widening Interstate 93, which was the favorite project of Senate President Chuck Morris. He insisted that money go there. In other words, none of the money went to this structural deficit, this fact that unless there's more revenue in this system in the next couple of years, you may have to lay off as much as a third of the employees at the Department of Transportation. So I commend this woman. I think she is very gifted and very smart engineer. I hope she's got some political skills because, frankly, you're going to need them. And that's what's really burned out a lot of these commissioners over the years. It's what felled the first woman DOT commissioner, Carol Murray. She left after she lost basically political confidence from the governor and the legislature at that time. She was a career employee. She was very well liked by her peers. But lack that, that political oomph.
That's interesting. So the commissioners tend to be people, Kevin, who have that transportation background. Yes. That's what you want. Engineering.
Yes.
They know about roads. They know about bridges. They know about, bus schedules or whatever. But some perhaps have not had the sharp political skills that they need to figure out the legislature and the governor how to navigate that and the exec council.
Exactly. And it's tough. Remember Chuck O'Leary saying, drive fast and don't look back, when he was talking about how bad the bridges are. The point being here that in order to get the legislature to pay attention, you have to be a shock jock. You have to create what is a calamitous situation for them to realize, hey, we got to throw more money at the Department of Transportation. Once you do that, you have legislators who are saying you're fear-mongering, you're scaring people. Our roads are the envy of America.
Well, that quote was a long time ago, and people are still using it. Exactly. Go ahead, Rick.
The headwinds that Kevin mentions, the structural deficit at the state level, gets compounded now, too, by the fact that it used to be you could rely on some federal money to come in and ease the burden, not erase it, but ease it. Well, that federal money has been trickling down, down, down over the years with no sign. I still don't think we have a trust fund deal in Washington, right? The Highway Trust Fund. So that's that's a problem that this new commissioner will also be inheriting.
Yeah. Well, speaking of federal dollars, Dean, I'm going to ask you this real quick, and maybe we'll pick it up after the break. The Londonderry School District has decided to opt out of the federal school lunch program. How come?
Right. Well, in order to get funds from the USDA, the federal government, you have to serve what is called a reimbursable lunch, and there are very sort of explicit guidelines about fat content, calories,
salt.
Quantity, salt, everything. So it's sort of heavily regulated. And, Londonderry has decided that kids just don't like what they're required to offer in order to get the reimbursements. So they're basically throwing stuff away or maybe buying two lunches so they can get the stuff they like in a sufficient quantity but not eating the other stuff.
Throw
the peas out, right. So there's just we've heard about this around the country. This is a big battleground over child health as these sort of student lunches and just tremendous amounts of food being thrown away because kids don't like some of the new regulations. So Londonderry is still going to have free and discounted lunches, but it's going to be paid for by the district so they can decide what they want to serve.
Well, it's real interesting. So Londonderry, pardon the pun, bagging the federal school lunch program. All right. We'll talk more after a short break. Lots of presidential activity, and we'll find out about that wandering emu in central New Hampshire. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines, and you can join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. This week, our guests are Rick Stevens, Associated Press correspondent for Northern New England, Kevin Landrigan, he's chief political correspondent with NH1 News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. And gentlemen, it wouldn't be a Friday news roundup these days without talking a little bit about the presidential candidates. And Dean, kicking off with you, please. This is a big weekend for Democrats.
That's right. It is the state Democratic convention at the Verizon Wireless Arena on Saturday. I believe they've got about 3,500 people attending. It's a very large turnout. It may be the largest they've had in a long time, so there's a lot of excitement among Democrats. All the candidates will be speaking there, with the exception of Jim Webb, the former Virginia senator, who was announced as being there but apparently will not unless that has changed in the last day or so. So big opportunity for Democrats to get enthusiastic about their slate of candidates. There'll be all kinds of speeches by members of Congress, state officials, and I think now that we know that Governor Hassan has finished the budget, there's going to be a lot, all kinds of speculation about how that all is going to play out over the weekend.
Yeah, and Rick, Governor Hassan said she's going to endorse Hillary Clinton, right?
Today, yeah.
She's doing that today at the University of New Hampshire, yeah. I think they're going to peg it to the whole to Hillary Clinton's college affordability plan and kind of loop that in at the college campus.
So. Sure. So Hillary Clinton now has Governor Hassan, or will have Governor Hassan, and Custer endorsed earlier, Jean Shaheen endorsed earlier. What does this say, Kevin, about Bernie Sanders, which we could call Hillary Clinton's chief rival?
Sure,
if
we
you're
could.
Looking at polling?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it says what we've known from the very beginning. He's the insurgent candidate, and she's the establishment candidate. And that's just the way both want it, you know, I mean, which is going to make for a fun campaign in the fall. Bernie Sanders loves running as the underdog, and he loves not having all the trappings of a front runner. He's not unhinged, but he's certainly unshackled, you know, so he can talk freely and will talk very forcefully and try and go bigger than Hillary Clinton on a lot of issues, and college affordability is one where he's going bigger than Hillary Clinton's plan right now.
And the instructive example there is 1996. Bob Dole was the Republican candidate, Senate Majority Leader. Virtually every major elected official in the state endorsed him and kind of ushered him around the state. Pat Buchanan won the New Hampshire primary that year. So establishment support is no guarantee of anything. This is going to be a very tight race.
You know, although we had a great sit down with Andy Smith recently talking about primaries past, given his new book, and he said, Dean, and you'll probably confirm this, that you're right. Establishment support does not mean you will win the New Hampshire primary, but it usually does mean you win the presidency.
Mm. That could be, certainly. I'd have to look at the data. If Andy's making that argument, there's probably something there. It's certainly the nomination. Well, I mean, it's certainly a support of you're likely to have more money. You're likely to have a better luck with the superdelegates and particularly among for the Democrats. So certainly, I mean, I think it may be a sign of kind of larger feeling sort of among the national party that you need to have somebody with a lot of support. But, you know, here in New Hampshire, lining up officials, certainly a good thing to have. Doesn't mean you're going to win the primary.
Rick?
I'm not sure Sanders is all too worried about endorsements. He started
like
this race with his own Democratic governor, Democratic congressional delegation endorsing Hillary Clinton from the state
of Vermont.
So,
yeah.
And meanwhile, Sanders continues to stay very high in the polls, nipping at her heels the whole way. I don't think he's too worried about
– Or going ahead in some
instances.
Ahead
in some polls.
Right,
exactly.
In Iowa and New Hampshire. All right. Again, it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you as we cover some of the big stories of the week. We've covered a lot, the state budget, the new transportation commissioner, Londonderry deciding it doesn't want to go with the school lunch program. Now we're turning to presidential politics, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And up next is Paul in Concord. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hey, Laura, it's Paul Steinhauser from NH1 News. How are you?
Hi. Kevin Landrigan's here today as well. Great to have you, Paul.
I know. I just interviewed Governor Hassan, and Kevin was going to be with me, but he had a more important thing to do, which would be on your amazing show. But Kevin gave me a lot of smart questions to ask the governor about the budget. But after I talked to her about the budget deal with her, I did ask her about why now, why the endorsement now about Hillary Clinton.
Sure.
The timing is fascinating. And she kind of downplayed, well, you know, it's scheduling. We had to figure out with the staff when she would be here, when I would be available. But let's be honest, the Shaheen endorsement 2 weeks ago, the Custer endorsement earlier this week, and now the Hassan endorsement, it comes as Bernie Sanders has topped Hillary Clinton in 6 straight polls in the Granite State. The Clinton campaign says this is just because it's post-Labor Day. People are now tuning in. That's why we're rolling out the endorsement. I don't know, guys. What do you all think?
Wow.
It is. The timing is extremely interesting. All 3 of these ladies, we knew we were going to endorse Hillary Clinton, but the timing now with Bernie Sanders surging in the state, What does that tell you guys?
Did you say, Paul, six straight polls in the Granite State put Bernie Sanders ahead of Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, but BUR came out 2 days ago. That was the sixth straight poll that showed Bernie Sanders topping Hillary Clinton here in the Granite State. And, you know, listen, his campaign is getting bigger. The structure is getting bigger. He's now got 8 campaign offices. He's up to 40 full-time staffers in the state. This is a real race here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, what do you think, Kevin?
No, I think Paul's nailed it. I mean, these endorsements, particularly when you know what they're inevitable and they're going to happen, these are bullets you don't waste. You know, you save them when they can have the most impact, you know, on your opponent's body. And ordinarily, these are endorsements, back to Paul's point, that you would hold on to. You would hold Governor Hassan's endorsement until after Thanksgiving when you thought you would need it. The timetable has been moved up because of the Bernie phenomenon.
Yeah, Dean.
Yeah, you know, I think Kevin's right. I mean, but, you know, I'm sort of ambivalent about how important endorsements are in the end. I do think that they signal, sort of among political elites kind of, you know, sort of where people are moving. So having them endorse now is kind of a way to reassure people within the party that, you know, sort of the big players, Governor Hassan or Gene Shaheen or Annie Custer, that they have confidence in Hillary Clinton and the campaign. So it's a way to kind of shore up support. The flip side is, you know, sort of the kind of people who are supporting Bernie Sanders, this is just more sort of establishment politics. This is exactly
just
what they're upset. Yeah, it just sort of eggs them on even more. It's going to mobilize them even more. So, you know, I think this is mainly, I think, for sort of internal to Clinton world and the need to kind of shore up the confidence in the view of all these polls. But, you know, for Bernie Sanders and the people supporting him, this is just sort of more of the same.
Paul, I got to ask you a question since you had a sit down with Governor Hassan just this morning, and it's great to hear from you. Did you ask her whether she's going to run for governor or U.S. Senate?
Yeah, Kevin and I talked about how I should approach that question. I did ask her about that. And unfortunately, I wish I could give you some breaking news. She said the same thing, that she would have a decision sooner rather than later. I followed up saying, listen, Stephanie Shaheen out of Portsmouth yesterday hinting about possibly running for governor. She wouldn't have said that unless she knew something. Governor Hassan, what can you say about that? And she said that the Shaheen comments just point to the fact that she needs to get that decision out sooner rather than later. Didn't give me the decision. Sorry, no breaking news.
Okay. Appreciate you trying, Paul. Thank you very much for being with us.
You guys have a great day.
Great job, Paul.
That's Paul Steinhauser. Again, Kevin Landergan's colleague at NH1 News. He's been out on the political trail this morning. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us as we cover some of the top political headlines of the week. So, Dean, as we were saying, big week for Democrats, given that there's a convention this weekend. How about Republicans? A lot of them are in California this week for that debate.
Yeah, they're still recuperating from the marathon. It was like started at 6 and it ended at 11 between the two rounds of the debate. I don't know that I've ever watched a 3-hour presidential
debate. Did you watch the whole thing?
Yeah, I did. I actually watched the whole thing.
You're a political guy.
Got to watch it. But and I think that was unusual. I think I don't recall there ever being one that long. Yeah, you know, people are kind of waiting to see if anybody gets kind of a short-term boost out of those debates. You know, my feeling is with the debates, occasionally you can kind of reshuffle the deck. A lot of times it's a temporary opportunity for candidates to maybe raise a little bit more money or get a little bit more visibility. The press afterwards and the social media frenzy afterwards is almost as important as being in the debate itself. So you know, we'll see. The polls have sort of – we've had a couple weeks now or several weeks where it's just kind of been Donald Trump and Ben Carson on top everywhere, and then you know, maybe Carly Fiorina or John Kasich, depending on the state, doing well also. There was so much buildup for this debate. I think we're now kind of looking to see how it plays out over the next week or so.
So a couple of Republicans were in the state earlier in the week. There was a chili fest on the seacoast, Carly Fiorina, George Pataki, John Kasich, and then Donald Trump, Dean, right, was in Rochester last night.
Town hall meeting.
Yeah, and there was sort of a headline out of that. Just set it up. We've got some sound, but I want you to set it up for us.
Absolutely, and I just sort of, you know, it's interesting to show you Trump's strength as a candidate. Anytime he speaks at a town hall in the evening, all the cable networks – cut to him. I just sort of as a test, when he started speaking at 7 p.m. last night, you know, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, et cetera, everybody's cutting to him speak, and it's not the first time that's happened. So he didn't really have much to say. He said, I'll open it up to questions. The first question was from a gentleman who said President Obama's a Muslim, he's not an American, and there are terrorist camps, et cetera.
All right, well, let's hear that.
Yeah.
Come on. Okay, this man, I like this guy.
Amen. Okay. We have a problem in this country. It's called Muslims. We know our current president is one. Right. You know he's not even an American.
We need this
first
question.
Certificate,
this
man. First question. But anyway, we have training camps growing where they want to kill us.
To which Donald Trump tread pretty lightly.
We're going to be looking at a lot of different things. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that, and a lot of people are saying that bad things are happening out there. We're going to be looking at that and plenty of other things. Okay, go ahead.
All right, and again, that voice you heard in the middle was NHPR's own Emily Corwin, our Seacoast reporter. So she was on it. Wow, how's this going to play, guys? Anybody want to jump in? Jump in there?
It's getting a tremendous amount of play, in part because there was a similar episode like this back in 2008 with John McCain and an elderly woman who said something very similar about President Obama's citizenship. And McCain took the microphone away from her and said, "No, ma'am, he's an American and he's a fine, upstanding family man. I just disagree with him on policy." So people feel like Trump kind of missed an opportunity here. On the other hand, a lot of the people who are supporting him feel very strongly. The immigration has struck a chord with them. They're very concerned about terrorism. So, the man asking the question at the beginning is not alone in his opinion. I listened to some of the reporting and interviews with people who were at the rally afterwards. A lot of people basically agreed with him. So it's sort of a potentially missed opportunity for Trump. But it's getting a lot of coverage.
Kevin.
I was just going to say, it's fascinating to see because it really speaks to what happens when a candidate goes from phenomenon to front runner and what you do as a result. Here's a guy, by the way, Trump, who's pretending he's not Aladdin. Okay. You're the guy who rubbed the lamp. You're the one in 2008 during the presidential cycle who questioned whether Obama was a resident of America or not, whether he was born here or not. This whole talk about immigration, this is what made you, Donald, as a presidential candidate, this kind of fervor over people who were distrusting illegal immigrants and people coming in and stealing jobs from this country. Now Trump has reached a critical mass as a candidate, and this energy that Dean talks about, this caustic commentary about the people who hate and loathe Obama, it can be toxic to the front runner. He has to be very careful. Even the Donald has to watch what he says. It's fascinating to see him deal with it.
Well, very interesting. Rick, did you want to jump in? You're all done there. All right. Well, I did want to ask you, Rick, to help us kick off this last segment. I'm going to call it the Critter segment because there was news about two really kind of adorable critters in the Granite State this week. There's a lost emu in Bow capturing public attention in the Capital Region. Now, I did not have a chance to check this morning whether this poor emu has been found. It's wandering around Bow, Concord, who knows where.
Last I know, there was no emu captured today. I let Kevin and Dean handle the heavy-duty political. If you know. I do the things with fur and feet. But yeah, so this emu, it's a giant bird, native of Australia.
It's very giant. Tell us
very
how giant.
Very giant. Well, it's the size of an ostrich. It's huge, bigger than an ostrich, I think. I think it might be the biggest land bird around. It's a giant bird. The Concord Monitor had a wonderful little everything you need to know about emus in their edition yesterday. I think it was go check that out in the Monitor. But they are kept as pets in some cases. They are bred here and they are kept on kind of the way you see alpacas and llamas being kept around. And this one got out on the loose. Dean mentioned this morning that it's got its own Twitter account now.
It's tweeting.
The emu has a Twitter account?
Yeah, of course. Yes. And tweeting in an Aussie accent, too. Very clever. Yes.
It also is polling better than some of the lower tier presidential candidates at this moment. But
emu was it? Do we know?
We don't know.
The owner isn't fessing up?
Not yet. The Bow police have checked with emu owners, and they apparently know where the emu owners are, and they haven't found any of their animals to be missing. So they just don't know where this thing came from. They're getting in touch with wildlife rehabilitators and capture specialists. So when they do, there is a sighting. Maybe they can round this thing.
Wow. Okay. Well, I've been looking out my windows, in the morning. Let's take another call, gentlemen. And Earl's in Newfane, Vermont. Hi, Earl. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Laura. Hi. It's funny that we were sitting in our yard one night, one morning at 8 o'clock, and we saw this creature outside our window eating apples off the ground.
Okay.
And it was kind of like dark, and took a closer look, and it was this emu. big, huge bird.
When was this, Earl?
This was 2 weeks ago.
Maybe it was the emu from Bo.
It is. What I'm kind of dumbfounded in that it's over in New Hampshire now, because it was in Vermont for about a month, or there were actually two of them that escaped, mainly because a third one had been attacked by Kai wolves. Ooh. And so they became terrified, and they escaped from their compound where they were staying here in Newfane, Vermont. Actually, it was Townsend. I'm sorry, West Townsend, Vermont.
Sure, I'm familiar with Townsend.
It's hard for me to believe that how they would ever get over to New Hampshire. But they were offering a reward for its capture, and we almost had it captured here. We had it in our garden, but she figured out how to get out of it. And very, very wily, very smart animal. And very difficult to capture. So
the Bo Emu, Earl, is from Vermont.
Yes, it is.
And is it supporting Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton? Sorry, couldn't
resist.
We didn't
get that far in the conversation.
Well, Earl, thank you so much for calling in. Real interesting. And maybe the Bo police have got their ears on today and are checking that out with the folks in Vermont. Thank you so much, Earl. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye.
All right. So, all of you, super quick, what are you covering next week? Kevin, you going down to that convention in
Convention's going to be really important. You know, what's interesting, actually, is that today is the deadline for people to file information for new legislation for next year, believe it or not.
Already? Wow.
Already. So, this year, as you know, is all about eating the Londonderry peas, the state budget. There's a lot. In election, I always look forward to the bills during an election year. You're talking God, gays, guns, a lot of sexy, saucy topics.
All right. Awesome. We will have you back to talk about those. How about you, Rick?
I'm writing about mysterious stone formations in the state of New Hampshire. Stay tuned.
Very interesting. With emus walking around.
And cotton-tailed rabbits.
Okay, Dean.
It's all presidential stuff at this point. I'll be watching that convention very closely. See what Maggie Hassan does.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.